Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is Friday.
The human comedy can take some unexpected turns. Farce becomes drama in an instant.
Zelensky's showbiz career was all comedy and light entertainment. That path has led him to the role of wartime president.
And when history comes calling, it is often not the strong man who answers. Underneath their bare, puffed-up chest, the soul shrivels, revealing their inner frailty.
And that is the opening of Tim Miller's latest Not My Party. Good job, Tim.
I've been working on my announcer voice. How did I do?
It was very, very it was very impressive. You know, before we get into the absolutely horrible situation that we're in right now, and particularly the terrifying night that we spent last night wondering whether or not we were going to have a nuclear power plant blow up, it is worth just dwelling on the power and the influence of one person. I talked about this yesterday with Rachel Vindman, but it's still extraordinary. The story of President Zelensky and the way he has risen to this moment and inspired not just his own people, but the Europeans. And it is possible that had he been like President Ghani of Afghanistan, that none of the things that we're seeing now in terms of the sanctions, in terms of NATO, in terms of, you know, civil society rallying against, that none of this would be happening. And it does seem kind of a throwback, an anachronism, that one courageous person would have this much impact on history, right?
For sure. I think particularly folks in my generation and younger, I think it's been hard to look and find, you know, examples of, you know, political heroism, right? Somebody that you can be like, this is someone who in politics I can look up to. I mean, you know, sure, you could say, you know, Barry Dunn, the Capitol policeman, or yeah. I don't know, Sully, or, you know, who landed the plane, right. Or, you know, there have been examples of heroism, of course, in the post 9/11 era. But in our politics, in our, you know, world leaders, you know, there hasn't, you know, really been an absence of it, I think. And it's like transformative
courage. I mean, that's how it separates out, right? It's not just, you don't admire it. It's like, okay, and this, it changes everything.
Yeah. I mean, the world, the change of history. And I think I wanted to get into this as you go deeper into the episode where I get more serious. I didn't want to give him the fun opening trailer that he deserved, you know, the hype video. No matter the outcome of, you know, the battle in Kyiv and throughout Ukraine, and no matter the outcome with Zelensky, I mean, I was worried a little bit while we were taping this. I mean, Zelensky could be alive or dead by the time the episode came out, right? I mean, it is, you know, said that, you know, he's has a bounty on his head, is the number one target of Putin. On the live stream last night, I was asking, David Frum and Mona and Bill things to be worried about. One thing everyone's worried about is if Zelensky, you know, dies, what happens to the Ukrainian resistance? I mean, that demonstrates his strength, that one person has that kind of influence. And you know, but even if it goes the way we don't want it to go, you know, NATO has rallied together. The free world has rallied together in a way that we haven't in a generation. And, you know, it very much could have gone another way. You know, imagine if the Ukraine was the Ukraine that the Putin apologists on the right and left, you know, want you to think it is, right? That it was this corrupt oligarchy, that it wasn't really a democracy, that the people didn't admire their leaders. Imagine that it was really that type of government, and there was really that type of corrupt leader. I mean, Putin would have just marched to Kyiv. Right. You know, he would have done what Ghani did. He could have left with suitcases full of cash. He could have left to Moscow, you know, where the oligarchs put him up in a yacht. There are all sorts of different outcomes that could have happened over the past week had Ukraine not had somebody with the resolve of Zelensky. And we've gotten the best case outcome. And that really is, you know, different from you know, it's Churchillian. It's different from what we've seen in modern times.
Well, Churchill, you know, does keep coming to mind, even though this may have a different outcome, which we'll come back to in a moment. But in terms of rallying the world, Ben Parker has a really interesting piece up at the Bulwark today, where he points out that it's not just the West and NATO. There's this just massive mobilization of civil society, you know, non-state soft power. And he's talking about, you know, private companies, you know, with a lot of financial risk, you know, BP and Exxon, you know, pulling out of joint ventures with Russia, Boeing saying it's not going to, it will discontinue all activity. Warner Brothers, you know, says it's not going to release Batman. It goes on and on and on, you know, FedEx, UPS, Bain, Boston Consulting, McKinsey, Apple, all of these major companies abandoning a market of 140 million people. And it just keeps going on and on and on. So we are seeing the world rallying in, and not just in a political way. And frankly, it does come back to Zelensky, not just Zelensky, but obviously Zelensky as a symbol of the Ukrainian people.
Yeah, as a symbol of the Ukrainian people, for sure. But also as a symbol for, you know, liberal democracy. That might seem a little esoteric, but look, we were at a moment in, you know, 6 months ago, particularly a year ago before, you know, Biden had won, where it felt, you know, there was kind of this sense in the air that liberal democracy was a little bit on the wane, right? On the run.
Oh, very much.
And that the strength, right, was in the strongmen, the autocrats. Whatever you think about Ben Rhodes's, you know, tenure at as Obama's national security advisor, he had a book after his time there that I thought was really insightful, that talked about his concerns about this, you know, and he went around the world and saw, as China is on the rise and Russia, you know, Putin has regained power. And then you've got all of these, you know, Middle Eastern strongmen, you know, from Sisi and MBS. And, you know, it felt, you know, when you were traveling around the world, you know, into some of these, you know, other rising countries where they didn't know where to place their chips, right? For a while, it seemed obvious to place their chips with the U.S., but maybe that wasn't the case anymore. Maybe you place them with China and, you know, cut a deal with the Saudis and the UAE, and that's a better bet, you know, for a South American country, you know, something of that nature. And I do feel like the leadership of Zelensky and the fortitude of the Ukrainian people and the weakness of Russia, and even if they win, just how mired they've been, you know, in an attack on, you know, a smaller country that really, you know, they should have just overwhelmed, and that all military experts thought they were going to overwhelm, I think puts a different perspective on all of that. And it was a needed perspective that buoyed, you know, that sort of reminded people that no, right, that you know, liberal, for all the flaws of liberal democracy, it's not as if these guys, you know, have a stranglehold on things. And I think that it's demonstrated their weakness. And just really quick, lastly, I think China is watching, and I don't think it's certain that they're looking at this and saying, boy, this makes our alliance with Russia look strong, right? And I think that demonstrates, you know, that this has been a moment that has hurt, you know, that revanchist alliance.
So I'm going to come back to maybe a slightly less cheery scenario on all of this, but you're making a very interesting point, because it did seem as if authoritarians were on the march, and particularly on the American right, there was this sort of, you know, fascination that maybe these strong men were the way to go, that maybe they were the defenders of Western civilization. And of course, we know about all of Vladimir Putin's, you know, many useful idiots out there. In fact, right before we started this, I read to you a tweet from Franklin Graham, the evangelical Christian leader, who last March 19th, 2021, felt the need to put out this tweet. President Joe Biden said, this is Franklin Graham, President Joe Biden said that Russian President Putin is a killer. President Biden's words have offended the Russian people and have set our relations with this country back considerably. Okay. Really, he felt the need to say that we've hurt Vladimir Putin's feelings by calling him a killer. I mean, there was this weird fascination. So I'm probably going to hate myself in the morning for asking this question. But does this change anything? Does this end the bromance between conservatives and people like Putin? I know on the live stream last night you were citing some of these Republican polls, which yeah. would suggest that the rank and file Republicans are not going along with, you know, Putin love or the kind of line that Tucker Carlson had been pushing until about 5 minutes ago. What do you think? Is there a break here?
Before I get around to the to directly answering the question, I do just want to echo that this has been going on for a while, right? And there was a Trumpian element to this that was mm-hmm, just mm-hmm. like his unique aberrant obsessed fetishization of like strongmen and the fact that like he just liked mean tough guys because he thought that was what it meant to be strong, because I think his father was a bad parent. But you know, it wasn't just that, right? I remember in the Obama era, you know, Dinesh D'Souza was a big pusher of this. I got into a Twitter fight with him of like this notion that Putin is a good leader and Obama is a weak leader, right? Like that, yeah. like even before Trump came onto the scene, that was something that resonated with people.
And if you looked at polls of
Republican mm-hmm. voters, yeah. you would yeah. see that. And mm-hmm. so, and then obviously this expanded to Orban, and, you know, as you pointed out, there's been this, you know, on an increasing sense on the right that, you know, these are the types of, you know, leaders that we should emulate, not the weak mm-hmm. little Zelensky types, not these little cucks, you know, the strong guys mm-hmm. that make you all be quiet. So I had been consistently worried that the Trumps and the D'Souzas and the Tuckers were tapping into something, and that they were actually that like on many other issues, they were reflecting a bottom up voter.
Yeah.
Feeling, right? Mm-hmm. And there were a number of things where the establishment was just out of touch, right? Immigration and trade and all these things that Trump ended up kind of being on the right side of where Republican voters were, not the morally right side. And on this one, I think the jury is just still out. And I think that there's just been a little bit of encouragement. If you look at the polls, Republican voters are unbelievably outraged by what by Putin's advance. If anything, and this might just be this instinct to always say Biden's weak, but if anything, if you look at polls, the Republicans want Biden to be tougher in his response. You know, so it's not as if Republicans are aligned with Biden, that we're not living in this kumbaya world, but at least we're not living in a world where Republicans are saying, you know, Biden should retreat and let Russia take over. And I do wonder if maybe there was, you know, the Tuckers and the Trumps were a little bit out of step on this one, and that there remains a vestigial kind of patriotism and sort of belief in the free world, particularly if you consider the Republican base is older. You know, these folks remember the Cold War, and that like kind of the very online right, you know, the younger, you know, people who came up during the Trump era who have gotten into this, you know, authoritarian, autocratic strongman fetish might actually not reflect the broader Republican electorate to the degree that I had been worried that they do, and so that, you know, a minor silver lining, I guess, about the Republican electorates.
Small green shoots. Okay, so let's treat this as a chess match where we have to think like four or five okay. moves along. Because right now, I think we, you know, feel the courage of the Ukrainians and are feeling a little bit of, you know, a surge of unity that feels sure. kind of odd. But we see the way that this is going, the incredible savagery of the Russian attack targeting civilian populations, the kind of things that we saw in Chechnya, except that the world is paying attention this time. And what is certainly likely, I mean, I'm not going to say probably, what's certainly likely is to see the brave Ukrainians crushed under the weight of this while we light up our buildings but don't do anything, okay? Now, I'm not suggesting that when I say do anything, I am not one of those saying that we should go in and start World War III. I agree with Tom Nichols on this. I think we need to be restrained, but it's going to be a really wrenching experience yeah. watching this the mass slaughter, the war crimes of the Russians. And then, of course, there will be the retconning of it, that we didn't do enough. A lot of the Republicans, I think the way this is going to play out is that we won't start World War III, but we will see something horrible happen in Ukraine, and then we will have the who lost Ukraine debate. And people like Donald Trump will come out and they will retcon this, that this was a failure of Biden because Biden did not go in and did not do a no-fly zone. All the people who, you know what I'm saying here? And they'll tap into the you should have been stronger, because it will be cost-free at that point to say that we should have, you know, right now, of course, if Joe Biden sent troops in or imposed a no-fly zone, they would be outraged. But in retrospect, watch how this plays out, because I think it's going to be an emotionally horrific experience, perhaps, watching what happens in Ukraine. I think there's going to be a backlash, and we know how cynical the critics of the president are going to be about this.
I do agree with this, and we have an optimistic moment here for sure.
Yeah.
But there's a very realistic, I don't think a worst case scenario. I think a very realistic bad scenario, right? You just laid out, and I think you see a little bit of that. Well, there might be some green shoots with Republican voters' answers. Republican politicians, you know, have not acted in the worst possible way they could act. They haven't all, you know, been J.D. Vance and Tucker, but they haven't acted well. You know, there's been no sense of, you know, signaling to the world that we are unified, you know, behind NATO here. You know, Kim Reynolds' response to State of the Union, I thought was unconscionable. It was just like she didn't even give one sentence of a nod to unity and to saying that, you know, I disagree with some of President Biden's policies, but I'm standing here just also sending the message to the world and to the Ukraine that, you know, the Republicans, the Democrats will be together with you and with free people. Like nothing like that. Not one sentence.
Nothing. No.
And you know, that would have been unimaginable, right? In the Cold War era, in the 9/11 era, right, that the outside party wouldn't have even offered, you know, basic pains to national unity. That has been disappointing, and I think that in the scenario you laid out, I don't even know if this is four moves down the board. This could be two moves down the board.
Yeah,
you worry about a situation where Ukraine doesn't hold, where you don't want to trigger World War III, and we can get into a little bit to what the strategic options are, and Putin does advance, and you see a response here from the American right that is like, well, you know, we needed a unstable strong man of our own, right, to prevent this from happening, right? And then this whole mood that I was talking about at the beginning about demonstrating the strength of liberal democracy, again, you know, it boomerangs back the other way. And you know, people on the right start to say, well, look, we needed Trump, you know, we needed this firm arm, we needed a crazy man, you know, you don't know what he could have done. He might have nuked Moscow, or he might have, you know, gone and cuddled with Putin and let him come through and, you know, taken his oil. You never know what a guy like that'll do. And that's what we needed. Not, you know, people, not patsies who were, you know, letting Macron take the lead, or, you know, whatever, you know, they would say. And that's a very realistic scenario.
Yeah, I think the their foreign policy will revert back to let's go Brandon here. So I want to talk about a number of things today. I want to talk about Bill Barr. I want to talk about the Supreme Court nomination. I want to talk about the ISIS bride. I want to talk about some crazy stuff that's happening in your backyard. But I also want to play for you a couple of sound bites, including the former guy calling into the conspiracy theorist, formerly known as the Money Honey, and had some thoughts about China and Tucker's. The agony of Tucker trying to figure out, you know, what he thinks and who he's going to blame for fucking it up so badly. But we'll do it right after this. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show, which features in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds like Ray Dalio and Malcolm Gladwell. Every Friday, Jordan also releases a Feedback Friday episode to respond to listener questions, covering everything from conventional problems like leaving a dream job to doozies like helping someone escape an abusive relationship. You could also hear the latest news about Russia, featuring a heavy-hitting interview with Garry Kasparov and his experience with authoritarian governments. And that's just the beginning. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R. In Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Okay, we are back with Tim Miller. Tim, you probably heard that the former president of the United States called in to the former Money Honey show, Maria Bartiromo.
Tokyo Maria?
You know, I'm sorry to keep saying this, but I mean, maybe we've been so numb that this is just an amazing, amazing, amazing it's an amazing moment to have a former president of the United States saying this. Let's just play this.
I want to ask you about that because a U.S. delegation is visiting Taiwan in a show of support. There are fears mounting of a Chinese invasion in Taiwan. Former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived there today, and he got a warm welcome. President Trump, do you expect China to invade Taiwan sooner rather than later?
I do, because they're seeing how stupid the United States is run. They're seeing that our leaders are incompetent. And of course they're going to do it. This is their time.
Of course they're going to do it. It's their time. Tim, this is the former president of the United States essentially inviting President Xi. Hey, you know, we're all weak and we're all stupid here. Why don't you go crush this free democratic country?
Oh, it is the former president? I thought that was Donnie from Queens calling into RT Radio, RT America Radio, RIP RT.
Would that sound any different?
No, it wouldn't. And it's insane. Look, and again, to what we were talking about at the beginning of this podcast, right? If any other former president, any other responsible politician, look at this and say, you know, and respond to that, well, we need to obviously take all threats seriously. We stand with our friends in Taiwan. But if I was them and I'm looking at what's happening in Ukraine and looking at the resolve of our friends in Europe, no, I don't, you know, I don't think that that seems like a very wise move. If you're looking at the collapse of the Russian economy, the collapse of the ruble, I don't think that this signals to any other countries that they would benefit from such a move. It is the most obvious patriotic bipartisan answer, and he doesn't have that in his bone, right? Nothing is about the human suffering that would come from the invasion of Taiwan. Nothing is caring about, you know, what about the arc of history, what could happen to real people who are now under the thumb of Putin, people whose family and friends have died. He doesn't think about any of that, right? It's all about how can I make Joe Biden look bad right now in this one minute?
And he's willing to provide, and I'm using this phrase metaphorically, I'm not describing an actual criminal act, but giving aid and comfort to the enemies of this country. And, you know, Mona Charon wrote this yesterday. She said, Trump essentially is inviting a hostile power to destroy a vibrant democratic ally, kill God knows how many innocents, and crush freedom to make his successor look bad. And the answer to that is yes. That's exactly what he's
in
doing.
One random call-in interview. You know, I mean, that's not even to serve any purpose. It's just, you know, compulsive.
This is their time. Do you remember, are you old enough, Tim? I'm not sure. No. Are you old enough to remember when former presidents actually didn't comment on things? You know, certainly would not try to undermine the foreign policy of their successor at a time of actual war?
Yeah, the opposite. I mean, look at H.W. Bush. I always just look back, and there have been plenty of examples, but right, and he was defeated by Clinton. Imagine the just, and Carter, right? Defeated by, these are incumbent presidents, defeated by their successors. You can imagine, you know, the bitterness, anger, very tough campaigns. And I mean, both of them just, you know, basically were on call for their successors, right? Like, you need somebody to go to Haiti because there's an earthquake? Like, I'm there for you. And like, we'll stand, you know, side by side. So, you know, look, it wasn't as if there was this perfect past or anything, but you have just this minimum level of commitment to the country over your own,
because they were
petty interests.
They were paid, which is also why they would show up at their successor's inauguration, because they did not want to tear the country apart, because they recognized that this was an essential ritual of the peaceful transfer of power in a constitutional republic. And none of that seems to matter anymore. And keep in mind that Donald Trump, the guy that called and said, yeah, the Chinese are going to invade Taiwan, this is their time, is still the prohibitive front runner to be.
I want to do more on that once we get to my friend Bill Barr. So
Okay. We're going to get to Bill Barr in just a second. Okay, just in a second. Okay, so let's talk about how
we have too much to talk about today, Charlie.
Yeah, I know. Trump is Tucker Carlson trying to retcon his slavish. Why shouldn't I root for Russia? Why should I hate Vladimir Putin? Well, that's not playing well. So he's come up with a new line. He's blaming Joe Biden and Kamala Harris for making him sound like an idiot. Listen to this.
And that, we must be honest, is shocking to us. We've been taken by surprise by the whole thing. We're not the only ones who were, but we're willing to admit it. The only thing more embarrassing than being wrong in your estimates is pretending that you weren't. So why didn't we see this coming, this total loss of control?
You, Tucker.
Well, because we assumed that if things were dire, serious people would be involved in fixing them. But we looked up and we saw Kamala Harris involved, and that reassured us. Harris had just come back from Europe, where she'd been conducting, quote, diplomacy with her allies. And that appeared to be proof this could not really be a big deal. The situation in Ukraine had been legitimately serious. If the future of Europe and the world hung in the balance, as now so obviously it does, of course, the Biden administration would not have sent Kamala Harris to fix it, because that's not her job. Kamala Harris's job is to trot down to the Blue Room periodically to greet delegations of TikTok influencers, or to cut occasional PSAs for the Children's Dental Health Awareness Month, which is in February, so we assumed she'd be working on that right now. But averting war with Russia, saving a civilized world, come on. That is absolutely not Kamala Harris's job. That was our assumption.
Yes.
But as noted, we were wrong.
Not we.
Why were we wrong?
You're an idiot.
Well, we spend a lot of time watching Kamala Harris. You probably don't. Unless you are a junior producer at MSNBC, you're probably not that familiar with Kamala Harris.
Oh my God.
We should say,
how long does this clip go?
We didn't underestimate Vladimir Putin. We overestimated Joe Biden.
You pathetic, snarky little twat.
He's such a piece of shit.
I'm sorry.
Such a piece of shit. I can't do it, say anything else besides that. I mean, it's just all bullshit all the time.
All right, let's just move on.
By the way? Is there a mouse in his pocket? Like, who's
suddenly we. Yes. We were misled by all of this.
One more thing before we move on. One more thing. This is also just, I know this is obvious to listeners, but you have to say it if we had to listen to all that. He was wrong. The government was right. I mean, our government has gotten plenty of things wrong. They made some intelligence failures in Afghanistan. We know about the ones in Iraq. They nailed this. Like, the Biden administration has not necessarily been perfect in the response to what's happening in Russia, but they nailed the intelligence side of this. They knew exactly what was going to happen. They told us what was going to happen. They publicized what was going to happen before Putin did it. Well, a lot of the snarky assholes like Tucker and Glenn Greenwald and all of them said, oh, and Matt Taibbi are like, no, they're not really going to invade. This is just the deep state trying to scare you to get the military industrial complex going. No, they knew it. They had the intelligence. They knew it exactly. They told the world that allowed gave Ukraine some time to prepare, and meanwhile Tucker was the one who was wrong the whole time. So in addition to just being a trolly, snarky piece of shit asshole, he was wrong, they were right.
Okay, so that's a great segue. Bill Barr. I have been on record as being a Bill Barr skeptic from the get-go. There were a lot of people who were going, hey, he's an institutionalist, give him a chance. I never thought that he was going to be the guy. But okay, so this brings us to today. He has got a book. He's promoting the book. Doesn't that sound familiar? Which, by the way, no one's going to buy this book, are they? I mean, I'm sorry. Who's going to buy the book? MAGA World is not going to buy the book?
Because if one listener buys this book, I swear to God, I'm banning you from the Bulwark Plus chat and everything. Yeah. Do not spend a cent on this person's book.
Yes, delete your app completely if you buy this fucking book. Okay, so he's got the book, but he's got some juicy stuff in there where he's meeting with Trump. And Trump is trying to get him to help him overturn the election. He's saying, look, all these reports of fraud are wrong. Trump listened, but he obviously was getting very angry about all of this. Barr said, and this is the Lester Holden number. Barr said that he told Trump, I understand you're upset with me, and I'm perfectly happy to tender my resignation. Barr said Trump then slapped his desk and said, accept it. And then, boom, he slapped it again. Accept it. Go home. Don't go back to your office. Go home. You're done. Okay, so that's pretty dramatic, firing him. In my newsletter this morning, I went back and I reread Bill Barr's resignation letter at the time.
Share with us a sentence from that.
Barr praised the president effusively, saying that he was, quote, greatly honored that you called on me to serve your administration, the American people, once again as Attorney General. I am proud to have played a role in the many successes and unprecedented achievements you have delivered for the American people. And then he goes on. This is the letter of recommendation he issues publicly after this happens, after he knows the president is demented and crazy and just fired him and trying to overturn the election. Your record is all the more historic because you accomplished it in the face of relentless, implacable resistance. Your 2016 victory speech, in which you reached out to your opponents and called for working together for the benefit of the American people, was immediately met by a partisan onslaught against you, in which no tactic, no matter how abusive and deceitful, was out of bounds. the nadir of this campaign, was the effect to cripple, if not oust, your administration with frenzied and baseless accusations of collusion with the K. And this is where I actually had a gif of somebody throwing up a little bit in their mouth. Okay, I would have helped. I don't know if Barr would have told us then, you know, when he resigned, what he's telling us now, as opposed to, you know, unloading this pile of bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gagging. I can't even look at him. I can't even look at him. Like, looking at his face, I was scrolling through my feed. Anytime I saw his face on that Lester Holt thing, like, I'll read what he has to say, but I can't look at his little droopy the dog, like, sad face, and just, like, with the chipmunk cheeks, and I can't even look at him. Like, he makes me so mad. And the idea, just to give just everything you laid out, just to put a little bit of perspective for people on the timeline. After the election is over, the president of the United States is pressuring his attorney general to help him fabricate fraud to overturn the election so that he can stay in power. The attorney general then, you know, walks away without telling anybody that the president is doing this. And he writes this just ball-cupping, effusive, obsequious letter about how historic and honored and marvelous he is. Between then and then a few days later, January 6th comes to pass. And we're supposed to, like, care what he has to say now, like, about all of this? We already know. So just go ahead and leak it to John Carl for his book and let somebody with some dignity tell the story, okay? I don't want to have to look at Bill Barr and hear from him. Like, he missed his moment. He has one more, to our point earlier about Trump being the front runner next time. Bill Barr has one more moment coming up. And it's the same moment that John Kelly has, and that Betsy DeVos and Mitch McConnell and Elaine Chao and all the other people who said that what Trump did on in the lead up to January 6th was horrible, and are trying to, you know, kind of say the right things now without actually doing anything. They have one more chance coming up. It starts around Thanksgiving of this year, and they can unite together to do what we did with Arvat and what other people did, and create a former Trump officials against Trump effort and actually try to campaign against him. And if it's for someone else that I hate, like Ron DeSantis, like, Trump is a unique danger, and these men and women have an opportunity to put their money where their mouth is. And until then, it's all just a bunch of bullshit because they want to get invited back to the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And I don't care. And I don't want to see any of their faces until the next moment comes. And if they all want to put some skin in the game and try to stop him, then okay. But until then, I can't look at him anymore.
Okay, I have a hard question here.
Please.
Who has enough juice to actually make a difference? So Bill Barr says this about Trump, comes clean, says, you know, it's dismaying that he would run for office. But Bill Barr, despite all of the toadying, despite all of the water that he's carried, he's got no juice in MAGA world, right? Right? He doesn't. He won't make any difference. You know, none of these guys that, you know, John Bolton doesn't have any juice. John Kelly doesn't have any juice, even though they were right there in the room. You know, Mark Esper wouldn't have any ability to do it. So who does? Right now, what would be the one voice? And the reason I'm going to tell you what in the back of my mind I'm thinking, you know, an alternative universe in late summer, and you tell me whether you disagree with me about this, late summer, early fall of 2015, if Rush Limbaugh would have said, folks, I have to talk to you about this. We cannot do this. We cannot get on the Trump train. He's not a conservative. He's not the man that we, you know, he doesn't share our values. We cannot do this. If somebody like a Rush Limbaugh would have come out against Trump when it was just liftoff, first of all, do you think that it would have made a difference back then? No. Okay. It would help. So who now? You mentioned Ron DeSantis. If Ron DeSantis says this, does that do it?
I don't know. Maybe the answer is nobody, right? I don't know. Yeah. I certainly don't think that there's a silver bullet person out there. But we have not seen I always go back to, and we don't want to do the, you know, Tim talked about the good old days with Charlie, but, you know, we never really have seen besides that one Wisconsin primary where it was the entire talk radio universe, you, Walker, Paul Ryan. Speaking of Paul Ryan, we listened to that long Tucker Carlson bite earlier, and I couldn't even make it through it. That's Paul Ryan's network. He's on the board there. Yeah, doesn't seem to have any problems with that. But everyone, you know, the entire establishment all said, no, we can't do this guy. And it worked. They squeaked it out. Wisconsin voted, you know, went for Cruz. Wasn't a great alternative, but whatever. It was better than this uniquely crazy person.
It was a terrible alternative.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But just how desperate we were.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so here we are, and that's never been tried again, right? And this is my point. I've talked to some of these folks, and you know, I say, like, you, Bill Barr, might not matter. You, Betsy DeVos, might not matter by yourself, right? But if, you know, there are 20 former Trump cabinet officials, if there are former Trump people that worked on his campaign, Kellyanne, and you know, then you have and you have a real alternative, a Ron DeSantis of the world, and they all get together and say, this guy can't do it again. Like he can't win. You know, he lied to you. He cheated you. He got you, right? Could that work? I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't work. But at least they would have – at least that would be an action of integrity and an action of dignity, not an action of saving face and wanting to get invited back into polite society. And I think – but I think that if you listen to Sarah's focus groups – I think it's an outside chance. He seems to have a stranglehold on all this. But if there was a group of people that stuck with Trump and that have, you know, respect, all going together, and there is a figurehead that is a person that MAGA people still listen to, not Mike Pence, somebody else. You know, I don't know. There's a fighting chance. But they're not even going to try because they're going to think, no, there isn't.
I am afraid that the fate of the Republic rests in the hands of the fucking snarky twat. That if it's not Tucker, I don't know else who can do it.
You really think Tucker could do it?
I think that
he has the one people over on his Putin love. Look, Tucker had to come backpedaling.
Give it some time. Give it some time. He will go from I'm rooting for Russia. Why should I hate Putin? To why wasn't Joe Biden and Kamala Harris tougher on Putin? I would have been tougher. They were weak. Just watch. He'll make that. Okay, so.
Just really quick, by the way. Why couldn't that work against Trump? What, like, right? I'm not saying that Trump is, I think Trump is probably impossible to beat in a Republican primary. But again,
I do wonder.
That's because I don't believe in the faith, in the courage and the integrity of the people that could run a campaign to try.
Because we have PTSD.
Right. But and I have PTSD. But why couldn't this effort work to be like, look at this feeble man that I've been trashing you for the last four years, the president, you know, who's sundowning and, you know, is so weak that he couldn't stop anything. This guy beat Donald Trump and we're going to run Trump again? Like, why? Can you imagine Tucker Carlson doing that whole shtick he just did about Kamala Harris, but turning it on Trump? And couldn't that
work? I can. Yes, I do think that would work. Here's the other, you know, fantasy, which I'm sure that our good friend Barry is going to put together. Right now, just get all of the clips of what's happening in Ukraine. I mean, the children, the women who are blown up, the buildings that are blown up, and just run that video with the soundtrack of Donald Trump praising Vladimir Putin. How brilliant, how savvy, and just play it over and over and over again.
Do you think Republican voters actually care about the people?
I don't give
Ukraine?
A shit about Republican voters at this point. I mean, honestly, at some point, though, I mean, I can tell the American people are repulsed by this. And I think that to the extent you can say, this is the guy, this is Donald Trump's friend, play the sound bites. We have the sound bites. We have the audio. Just bring them together. Okay, so Tim Miller.
Yep.
Pick a topic. Okay, we're going to throw it up here. It says, Berkeley, crazy congressional candidate in Tennessee, or the ISIS bride. Go.
We have to just do a little bit on the ISIS bride, but I want to do Berkeley before we leave.
Okay. Yeah.
Just because, I mean, the ISIS bride is really quite a story for our times, you know. And here we are. We're 50 minutes in. You can imagine in an off year. I guess we're not in an off year anymore. But 6 months out for an election, you have a Republican candidate who drops out of a race because of an affair he had. A race for Congress because of an affair he had with a jihadist. with the ISIS bride. You would think that could have been a show leader.
This is a good one. See, this is like, this is the producers keep giving us good material. Okay, so here's my pitch. Okay, Republican congressman running for re-election is caught having an extramarital affair. Boring. Okay, what if he's having an extramarital affair with an ISIS bride? Oh, nobody's going to believe that, right? I mean, come on. You know,
and it's pretty, I don't know.
It might be Hulu, but not Netflix.
We're going to get an explicit rating because I already said the S word a couple times. Yeah. But this is still a family podcast, so I'm not going to read the text messages he sent to his ISIS bride. But if you're the type that is interested in that kind of thing, there are some text messages on the internet, and they are really something. This was not a Cal Cunningham, you know, vanilla, I just want to look deep into your eyes type of affair. I mean, this guy, he got down to business. Van Taylor. But here's I think, the most the point that I want to get across about on this topic. For people who did not listen to The Next Level, before we knew he was, you know, cuckolding a jihadist leader with his bride, we were talking about Van Taylor. And we were talking about him in the context of he was a...
This is, by the way, the congressman that we're talking about.
Yeah, this is the congressman. I mean, down-the-line Republican, not, you know, a bulwark-friendly rhino at all. You know, this is not an Adam Kinzinger situation. He's been a down-the-line Trump backer. But he was one of the couple dozen that decided that we needed to have at least a 1-6 commission and look into it, right? So he didn't vote to impeach Trump. He didn't, to my knowledge, he didn't criticize Trump that any more vociferously than anyone else around 1-6, but he did vote for this commission. You know, thought we should, you know, the Capitol gets sieged. We should at least look into that. That was his apostasy. That was so bad for Republican voters in Texas that he got four primary challengers who all ran on the pro-insurrection platform against him. And that prevented him from getting 50% of the vote, sent him into the runoff, and now we have the ISIS bride reveal. So the MAGA congressman who had an affair with an ISIS bride was the normal mainstream candidate in the primary in Texas. He's going to get replaced by a crazier, more pro-insurrection, more MyPillow-ish candidate. So that's where we are. That's the state of the Republican Party as far as active primaries. So those green shoots we were talking about at the top, what's a red shoot? What's the opposite of a green shoot? I just wanted to
dampen
the green shoot.
Okay, so there's also this is a Republican candidate for Congress in Tennessee.
Yeah, my friend Morgan. Old Jeb Bush, just Jeb Bush supporter, Morgan Ortegas. Yeah.
Set this up for me, Tim, what we're about to listen to.
Yeah, so Morgan Ortegas could be Tim Miller, right? I mean, she was just in the sense of she was a moderate Republican. Like, this is not a crazy MAGA person, but she made the opposite calculation of me. Trump wins, and she wanted to, you know, be a State Department spokesperson so bad that she put on the red hat and swallowed her pride and went along with it. So she gets to go and be a Donald Trump spokesperson. And, you know, she has a good, you know, face for television. And so she parlayed that into like some Fox Business hits and, you know, probably mainstream Fox. I don't know. I don't watch Fox anymore. So she had a little media cred. And so she moved back to, I believe, her husband's district in Tennessee to kind of run as a MAGA candidate. Because it doesn't matter if you're a moderate squish, right? As long as you're loyal to Mr. Trump, that's all that matters anymore. And so she moves back to central Tennessee to run in a district. And local radio host, you know, gave her a little pop quiz about her district.
And here it goes.
It's that time of day again. Not for news potpourri. We have a candidate for the 5th Congressional District in our studio. And we're going to play a different game called Taking the 5th. Mm-hmm. All right. You're a good sport here to play the game here, Morgan. Or take us here. We have candidates come in. And we ask them their knowledge of the 5th Congressional District. You ready?
Yes.
Ready? Here we go. What three interstate highways are located in the 5th Congressional District?
Oh, I'm a terrible driver. I don't know that. I don't drive anywhere that I go.
Okay, it's I-65, I-40, and I-24. A country music superstar, a famous multi-Grammy award-winning performer, has a popular winery in the center of the 5th District in Arrington, Tennessee.
I have been to that winery.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it's great. I love that winery. Who owns it? I don't know who owns it, but I love it. We went there for the summer and had a picnic outside. It was beautiful.
Kix Brooks. So he's a Tennessean. Yep. Here's one. Who was Brigadier General Robert Reese Kneeland?
Mm.
Legendary Tennessee football coach. Kneeland Stadium named after him.
It just person after person, as she gets nothing. She goes 0 for 10 on basic facts about her district. They ask her about NASCAR. Oh, my husband's into auto racing. I you have to appreciate the Schadenfreude when you get it, right? You know, when someone just sells out that hard to try to pretend to run as a MAGA candidate, there's something about, I always enjoy those folks getting brought down a peg a little bit more than the authentic crazies, you know?
Well, I always appreciate people who go on a talk radio show unprepared. That somebody, some aide said, she probably go, well, what do we have next? Well, we have this this radio show. What is it? Oh, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's very lighthearted.
And then
she just gets absolutely destroyed.
Is this district, you know, she thinks I got this, right? Because the district is one of these gerrymandered districts where it like goes into Nashville and then kind of out into rural Tennessee, right? And so she's like, okay, I can do this, man. I can pretend to be a Southerner, right? I'm going to live in Nashville, right? And, you know, hang out with the country music celebs and, you know, do that. And then whatever, I'll drive out and see the people in the boonies when I need to and go to a country dinner and, you know, put on my fake accent and like it'll be fine. But no, every question that she got was about, you know, was about all of the small towns in her district. She didn't know what counties they were in. Really, really, it's worth, if you're just looking for a little pure Schadenfreude cringe, just listen to the whole thing. It's a little 2 minutes of your time,
which we always do. Okay, so before we started, you said, Charlie, whatever we do, when we're done with the ISIS bride, when we've done Ukraine, when we've done Bill Barr and talked about Tucker Carlson, I definitely want to talk about my friends in Berkeley, California. What are your friends in Berkeley, California doing? You didn't say friends, by the way.
This is just my biggest pet peeve right now. Berkeley's right. I didn't know this before I moved out here, so I was like Morgan Ortegas before I moved to Oakland. I kind of didn't realize how close Berkeley was to San Francisco. And like literally, Berkeley is like 2 minutes from Oakland. And so I didn't quite realize when I moved here how close I was going to be to this insane lefties. I did. I got here. They're right up the road.
Fortunately, you're not running for Congress in this district.
Yeah, exactly. I try not to go there as much as possible, but there are some good things about Berkeley. You know, there's some nice people there. But here's the problem. There is this kind of like Piketty, you know, privileged leftism that's happening in Berkeley where they do not want the city to be changed at all. You might have heard about, as part of the inflation process, nobody can afford to buy a house anywhere. And really can't afford to buy a house in Berkeley. It's like if you want to have a 2-bedroom condo, that's going to be $1.6 million. If you want to live in Berkeley. And, you know, so in this great bastion of progressive leftism, when I take my daughter up there, we do a little, there's some good rock climbing. And, you know, every house you go by has like an "In this house we believe" and a Black Lives Matter sign, but you don't see any Black people anywhere because they don't build any low income housing in the neighborhood. Well, there was a big announcement this week that the campus, you would think if you wanted to expand any housing anywhere, it would be the campus of Berkeley, which is what makes Berkeley a thing, the Cal, has been because of environmental laws, because of a lawsuit being put on by some local residents, the University of Cal Berkeley is going to have to let in 3,000 fewer students next year because, you know, building another dorm or whatever 3,000 runs afoul of the environmental, laws and regulations of the area. So here's the progressive position here by these local Berkeley, you know, activists, the Save Berkeley activists. They said that they don't want to build any more housing because they don't have the transportation infrastructure there. And they don't want the city to turn into one of those Asian cities like Kuala Lumpur. That's a real quote.
No, seriously? That's a real quote.
I don't have it in front of me, so it's not made a direct quote, but yes, they don't want to turn into those big, big Asian cities, and he lists a few Asian cities. They said that they're not going to let people get a wonderful, to our producer, Katie, a wonderful in-state public education at Cal. 3,000 kids are going to get denied that. Affordable housing, that's no. You know, we don't want to have any poors moving into the neighborhood. This is supposed to be, I guess we're told, this is supposed to be the progressive position. I don't understand how there is not a complete revolt from people on the left to this type of activity in Berkeley. I mean, it's astonishingly irresponsible. It is not in any sense liberal or progressive. And I just, they're against affordable housing. They are against public education. And yet somehow this is like supposed to be the most liberal place in America. Well, I do not understand.
But of course they're not, Tim, against affordable housing. They are not against free education. They just don't want it in their neighborhood.
Right.
I mean, they just don't want it here.
It's like Sacramento. Maybe we could just move the whole campus to Sacramento.
Right. It's like the people who are all in favor of alternative energy sources like windmills, except, well, I didn't mean here.
Not next door.
I didn't mean next. Yes, I didn't mean so that I could look at it or anything. So, but they're wrapping all of this NIMBYism in, you know, with a warm glow of concern for the environment, right?
Yes.
So, Tim, why do you hate the environment? Why do you want to pave over this beautiful paradise with these Kuala Lumpur residents?
Speaking of the environment, I've always wondered about this. So the pro-environment argument, right, is that we can't build. And so as a result, we have in California the worst traffic in the world.
Yeah.
So this has got to be great for the environment, right? Like people who are driving down to Silicon Valley every day, at least the pandemic changed that. But people who are, you know, having to drive an hour down to their Google and Facebook offices every day in bumper to bumper traffic. I don't know. You might think that building more houses in Silicon Valley, building more houses in San Francisco and Berkeley so that life is more walkable. I would think that might be better for the environment. But anyway, I don't, it is, it's just,
I am surprised.
It's like the whole thing is just, it's really infuriating and it's ruining some really wonderful, you know, places. I can make fun of Berkeley, but there's some marvelous parts about Berkeley, and Berkeley would be fine, like by adding in some more multifamily housing, adding in some high rises. Everybody would be okay. Adding in some affordable housing, the people of Berkeley would be okay. Having a few low income minorities living in their neighborhood, everyone would, you know, the culture of the neighborhood would survive.
You sound like, you know, having 3,000 fewer students getting higher education at this school is like a problem. So, you know, the most surprising thing about this story to me is that you are surprised by it.
I'm not surprised. Like, I'm outraged. I'm outraged, Charlie.
Okay,
outraged.
Okay.
It's just it is a pet issue, and it bugs me. And you know, anytime one of these come up, I like to talk about it because you know we have a lot of, you know, we have listeners from the Bay Area, and I don't, you know, sometimes I get surprised. Sometimes I'm talking to listeners. Sometimes I'm talking to liberal friends, and you know their little inner NIMBY comes out. And so, just like I like to shame my, not just like because it's much worse, but in the same vein that I like to shame my Republican friends who make Trump apologia, I do like to shame the liberal NIMBYs from time to time. Because give me a break.
There seems to be a certain amount of buyer's remorse happening in the whole San Francisco Bay Area right now.
A little bit.
Like, you know, we need to welcome everyone. We need to be as welcoming as possible. Oh, I didn't mean those guys who were shitting on my sidewalk.
Right? I mean, you would think, right? We could at least build a homeless instead of a dorm. I'm fine with that. Berkeley wants to meet in the middle. They want to give 3,000 less people higher education, but we want to build a dorm for the homeless people so there aren't any homeless around. I think that would be a nice thing to do as well. I'm for that.
By the way, I just want to put in a word for all of these super yachts that are being confiscated from the oligarchs. I just think it would be a great troll move to use them to house Ukrainian refugees now.
Amen.
I just think that would be outstanding. By the way, I could just do a shout out for your Not My Party this week, which is a great piece about President Zelensky and who he is and where he comes from. Because people might say, well, it's disrespectful to talk about the fact that he was the voice of Paddington Bear or that he was in Dancing with the Stars. I think it makes the story even more amazing that we're living through a scenario that would have seemed implausible if you would have pitched it to a movie producer.
And you never know what is within inside people. And that is what I tried to get across with this.
Right,
you really
right.
don't, right? And,
you don't.
And sometimes people really rise to a moment. And I felt like when this idea came to me, I was like, I felt very passionate. We had to do a Not My Party on this because if you watch Not My Party, you should. Or if you don't, you could tell your teens to watch it. The teens in your life to watch it. It's a lot of times. It's a lot of dunking. You know, it's a lot of me just talking about all of the charlatans and the cowards and the conspiracists and the assholes in our politics. And so I just wanted to, when someone really rises to an occasion. They deserve a moment. And I got cut from the episode, but I think that, you know, when this is all over, no matter the result for Zelensky himself, you know, I feel like we should do one of those old timey ticker tape parades for him, you know, and really try to kind of remind folks about virtue and about courage and the fact that, like, this really is within all of us, and just because we are all so negative right now, we should take a moment and celebrate it when we see it.
And I second that. Tim Miller, thank you so much for joining me again.
See you, Charlie.
And thank you all for listening to this weekend's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday, and we will do this all over again.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.